This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Reading Envy Pub. I'm Jenny, and with me today I have Seth Wilson. Hi Seth.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Seth, we knew from episode 7, way back last year, the Top Secret Dance-Off episode, and also from some other podcasts such as SFF Audio. I'm glad you're back.
I think I did an episode of Good Story is Hard to Find, too, with Scott on this podcast.
And we also have with us at the table, Barrett Newman. Hi, Barrett.
Hey, Jenny. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. You are a musician in the D.C. area.
That's right.
And yeah, we go way back.
We do, a few years at least.
Yeah, not too it's far. Funny.
Yeah.
It's nice to hear from you again.
Yeah, you too. Glad we could
do that. Since you're new to the podcast, Barrett, can you tell us what kind of books you like to read?
Sure. I can tell you maybe sort of the easiest ways to tell you some of my favorite authors, just sort of going back, people that come to mind immediately are Kurt Vonnegut. This is the one I read a lot in college. And I've read, I think, probably 8 or 10 of his books. I've read a lot of David Sedaris. I really enjoy Hemingway, Truman Capote. So I guess a lot, mostly American authors. I haven't read too widely outside of that, but recently I've been reading more nonfiction science inflected works by people like Carl Sagan and Richard Feynman that have been, you know, coming from a more artistic musical background, have been really interesting to me lately. So, yeah.
It's a wide range, really.
Yeah, I'm trying to. It's something, you know, my dad sort of instilled in me. So, trying to live up to that.
You know, this year's been a big nonfiction year for me, too, and I'm not sure why. I'm just reading a lot of it.
I think I've felt like I've always had inclinations more, like I said, more musical or artistic or linguistic, and I've felt recently like I'm maybe a little ignorant of certain areas, trying to fill in some gaps, I guess. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's kind of look at reading kind of like bodybuilding, where if you kind of read one genre, it's like going to the gym and only doing like triceps or something like that, and you know, you don't work out anything else. I say this like I'm someone who goes to the gym all the time. But I've been enough to make the metaphor anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Seth, are you finding in your new graduate degree that you're working on, is that stretching some new muscles for you?
It really is. Speaking of American authors, I'm taking a class on American Gothic literature, which is not my strong suit at all. I've mostly read British authors and older British authors, so we're reading William Faulkner and Toni Morrison, and we'll be finishing up with some Stephen King, so stuff that I've not read and is really challenging, particularly Faulkner. We just slogged through Absalom, which I can't really recommend it to especially a general reading audience, but even English scholars I think find it difficult.
Hmm. Well, now your Southern Gothic muscle will be stronger.
That's right. Exactly.
So I think you were going to start us off about a book.
Yeah.
What'd you bring today?
Speaking of nonfiction, first off, I have How to Watch TV News. The blurb for this is short, an important guide to understanding what you're getting and not getting from TV news. Postman and Powers warn that anyone who relies exclusively on TV for a knowledge of the world is making a serious mistake, and suggest ways to intelligently evaluate TV news shows. And this book was written 20 years ago. Powers is a media guy. I don't know a lot about him, but Neil Postman is an academic, or was an academic. He actually died in 2003. But he was a scholar of communications, kind of a disciple of Marshall McLuhan, who coined the terms global village and the medium is the message. So this book is very much about kind of the dangers and pitfalls of of absorbing the news in, number one, in a visual medium where he kind of throws cold water on that idea that a picture can tell 1,000 words, because he sort of challenges the fact that you can get any depth from watching something and then moving on to the next next news item. He kind of makes the comparison that TV news is centered around time, whereas print news is centered around space, and you can always add space regardless of whether it's maybe a little expensive or difficult, but there's no physical way to add time. So TV news is always constrained in that way. And then his kind of second and more major point is that it is, even in the 90s when he was writing, is funded by advertising, and so it's really catering to ultimately to the advertisers and to getting more viewers, and so is more entertainment. He talks about, you know, celebrity news anchors making millions of dollars. It's like I said, even though it was written 20 years ago, it's a book that I think is really still relevant today with the whole Brian Williams scandal and Dan Rather a couple of years ago.
You know, I just watched this documentary. I wonder if you've seen it. The 50 Years War. It's about the New York Review of Books.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
It is fascinating. And, of course, the New York Review of Books, it does have book reviews, but it also has news. But it just kind of talks about how they focus on news that other people wouldn't report on, either because of political pressure or it was too opinionated. And I don't know, I just hadn't really thought of it in that way, but it's definitely a print medium for sure that's been around for 50 years, so I think you'd really like it.
It's an interesting topic. I just watched Page One, which is a documentary about the New York Times. I think it's a couple years old, but what occasioned watching that was I had heard that it featured David Carr, who is a New York Times columnist who died recently and had overcome drug addiction and really kind of turned his life around and became one of the foremost journalists in the New York Times. And so he died recently, and so I found myself wanting to learn more about him. So I watched this documentary, but I think telling the news is a challenging proposition in any medium.
I wonder what those authors would think of the internet.
Yeah, I wonder about that. There is a slightly revised version of this book, but I listened to the audiobook. But in most ways, I don't even think it needed to be revised. It was pretty timely. I mean, obviously, it could have benefited from a second edition, including internet news sources. But things like Twitter, I wonder what someone like Postman, who really argued for the discourse, intellectual discourse, rational discourse of print, would say about Twitter and confining discussion to 140 characters.
Do you think there are any great print newsmen, newswomen out there anymore? Like, I can't think of... Well, I don't read the news. I can't really think of anyone.
I'm an NPR person myself, so that's my primary way of consuming the news.
It seems that... some publications, like, you know, the New Yorker maybe comes to mind, where they have longer format articles. Like, I feel like I pick up an issue of the New Yorker and there'll be a 20-page article, you know, so somebody can still really dig in on a topic and actually make an argument rather than, like you say, you know, have a 2-minute window for this subject and then it's on to the next thing. So I think it's there, but I think it's just being crowded out, maybe.
Yeah.
I wonder if John Stewart has read this book. It seems like something that would be right up his alley. You know what I mean? Like,
he's a smart guy. I bet he has.
It seems to be sort of one of his things he's sort of always harping on a lot, which I sort of agree with. So
yeah, he seems to deconstruct the news medium a lot. From what few episodes of The Daily Show I've seen,
he
does some kind of meta things around storytelling and news that suggests that he's really thought a lot about how news is presented. So I imagine he has. One of the interesting things that I've gotten on a Neil Postman kick, and I've read several of his books, one of which It was called Amusing Ourselves to Death. It was a 1984 book he wrote about television in general and its kind of destructive effects. And he tells a story recorded in Phaedrus, which is one of Plato's dialogues between Socrates and a student of philosophy named Phaedrus. And Socrates tells the story of the Egyptian god Thoth or Thuth, who goes to King Thamos and says, "Hey, I've invented this wonderful thing called writing. It's going to enable an incredible revolution in memory." And the king says, "Wait a minute, you've got this all wrong. It's actually going to make our memories worse. We're going to rely on these recorded documents rather than on our oral culture." So he, Postman, kind of uses this story as a metaphor for not so much for against writing, because he's obviously a proponent of print, but as kind of a metaphor for looking carefully at what technology does. And I think that's what he's advocating above all else, although he is pretty critical of television and other technologies, but he's really advocating that we take a careful look at what technologies we're bringing into our lives and what they're actually doing to us, rather than kind of passively, "Oh, look, new iPhone." And I'm as guilty of that as anyone.
Oh, sure. Why do I need to know something when I can Google it, I guess.
Yeah.
The modern take on that.
Yeah. I feel like I've read several books that kind of talk about that. The biggest one, of course, is The Shallows.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too.
Nick Carr, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he has another one called The Glass Cage that I've read recently, which is kind of about automation and how automation is damaging. Nick Carr, I have mixed feelings about him. I don't know if he's very effective in his story. I mean, for example, The Glass Cage, he kind of starts out by talking about how he misses his standard shift transmission car and how automatic shift took away some of the joys of driving. It didn't necessarily resonate with me, but I'm glad that there are a lot of people thinking very hard about these subjects, and hopefully it'll keep things from going off the rails one way or another.
Sure.
So that's all I got.
All right, well, I'm up next, and this book is one of the ones that followed me home again. I was at the library picking up a book I had on hold.
It followed me home. Can I keep it?
I went over to the new bookshelf, and the new short story anthology by Neil Gaiman was there.
Ooh.
Called Trigger Warning, Short Fictions and Disturbances. So I took it home, and I read it. And some of the stories in here I actually had read before. I'm trying to get to the index page here. Let's see. There was one that I think was released as a freebie in Audible, Click Clack the Rattle Bag. And I had read The Sleeper and the Spindle, which combines Sleeping Beauty and Rapunzel together. And one of the others seemed really familiar to me, but I couldn't remember where I had seen it. I really liked this anthology. And of course, with all short story anthologies, it's kind of like you like some stories better than others, just like right. A book of essays.
Yeah.
I really liked The Truth is a Cave in the Black Mountains. And I actually went and paid for the Audible version because he performs it with string quartet.
Oh, wow.
And that was really, really That's great. Cool. And so many of these are set in the Hebrides. Because I think currently obsessed with them, and that's one of my favorite places on Earth. So, let's see. The Man Who Forgot Ray Bradbury was really good. In Relic Oiron, which is set on the Isle of Iona, and it's about Columba and Oren, I can't say it quite right. And then there's a few in here that are actually poetry instead of short stories.
Oh, great.
And you can poke around the internet and find quite a bit of them because he performs them. One of them is dedicated to his wife, and it's about living statues because, of course, they had a living statue wedding.
Of course they did.
Of course they did. So I'm going to read a little bit from a story called Black Dog. And it's actually, have either of you read American Gods?
Yes, love it.
No, I have not.
Okay. Well, it's one of the novels that Neil Gaiman's best known for, where there's this character named Shadow, and he's in America, and all the gods that all the immigrants had brought to America with them, the people have forgotten them. They've abandoned them for commerce and whatever, you know, whatever their other goals are. And so the gods are angry and bored, and you know, it's a really interesting book. I haven't read it for a while, so I'm probably not doing it justice, but in this story it's kind of like a prequel in some ways. And so the character is in a small town, I think it's just in England, let me see if it says. It's quite a long story, it's told in parts, I think it just says it's a pub, but it's a very northern type city. It's very rural and old. There's an old stone wall, an old cemetery. And so it kind of explains part of the main character Shadow's story before he came to America. And in the introduction to the story, Neil Gaiman says that there's still another part of the story to be told, which I'm hoping is going to be a novel, because that would be really amazing. That's kind of a little teaser there, I thought. So this little part that I'm going to read is from section 4, The Kiss. Everything was quiet in the house. Shadow imagined the black dog squatting on the roof, cutting out all sunlight, all emotion, all feeling and truth. Something had turned down the volume in that house, pushed all the colors into black and white. He wished he was somewhere else, but could not run out on them. He sat on his bed and stared out the window at the rain puddling its way down the window pane, and felt the seconds of his life counting off, never to come back. It had been wet and cold, but on the third day the sun came out. The world did not warm up, but Shadow tried to pull himself out of the gray haze and decided to see some of the local sights. He walked to the next village, through fields, up paths, and along the side of a long, dry stone wall. There was a bridge over a narrow stream that was little more than a plank, and Shadow jumped the water in one easy bound. Up the hill there were trees, oak and hawthorn, sycamore and beech at the bottom of the hill, and then the trees became sparser. He followed the winding trail, sometimes obvious, sometimes not, until he reached a natural resting place, like a tiny meadow, high on the hill, and there he turned away from the hill and saw the valleys and the peaks arranged all about him in greens and grays, like illustrations from a children's book. He was not alone up there. A woman with short dark hair was sitting and sketching on the hill's side, perched comfortably on a gray boulder. There was a tree behind her, which acted as a windbreak. She wore a green sweater and blue jeans, and he recognized Cassie Burglass before he saw her face. Dun, dun, dun!
That's really, I mean, it's really gripping. I mean, just the line about the seconds of his life ticking away. I mean, what more do you need? that's a really cool, that's a cool line. I like that.
And after hearing Neil Gaiman read his own stuff so often, I hear it in the pacing of his voice.
Yeah.
So you almost feel like what he meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's so good at setting a mood and bringing you into the place, and you just kind of have to settle in and let him tell it to you, you know?
I felt colder as you were reading it.
Yeah.
American Gods is one of my favorite, probably top five favorite books of all time, at least so far. And the sad thing about that is I feel like he set the bar really high, and I haven't really enjoyed much that I've read from him since then. So I don't know. I feel like I have mixed feelings about Neil Gaiman. I feel like a lot of the stuff he's done, Ocean at the End of the Lane was his last full-length novel, and it didn't connect with me at all. So I'm really waiting for him to kind of go back to this universe or write kind of more adult fiction, because he's been doing a lot of children's literature lately. And the Graveyard book was good. It's a kind of an adaptation of the Jungle Book, where a boy is raised by ghosts and other figures in the graveyard. And it was fun, but it wasn't as kind of profound as American Gods is. And that passage that Jenny read is is definitely an appropriate example of the kind of stuff that's in there. So I'd love if you would spend some more time in that universe.
I feel like he's going to. I feel like he's being called back to it. It's been at least 10 years.
Yeah, 2001. There was talk of a TV pilot that was going to air on HBO, and I think HBO decided that they already kind of had a genre piece with going with Game of Thrones. They didn't want to introduce a second one, and so the last I'd heard was AMC was looking at it, but I think that's kind of stuck in limbo, and obviously I prefer book to TV adaptation anyway, so.
Sure.
How old is Neil Gaiman? Do we know? He's probably, just wondering how many, he's probably got a lot more books left in him, so.
Yeah. I bet he does. He's youngish.
Yeah.
I'm so bad at age.
Yeah.
And he's kind of had a regeneration with, like, getting remarried and,
He's 54.
Okay. Yeah, so he's got time.
Well, I think American Gods is one of the best that he's done, but honestly, I think his masterpiece is Sandman, the graphic novel series, the comic book series.
Oh, I know of that. I've not read it, but...
His storytelling and paired with the artist that he chose... it's just unforgettable. I think about those characters, and I hardly ever think about characters outside of the books. So it's definitely worth a read. I haven't actually read the prequel because he most recently did those, and I haven't read them. I don't know what I'm thinking. I really should do that. I'm gonna write it down.
He did another graphic novel that I didn't read the whole series, but it was Marvel 1602, and it was sort of the Marvel Universe reimagined set in kind of Elizabethan England.
He did?
Wow.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was the writer on that.
Oh, I hadn't heard of that one. So many things to read.
I know.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm done talking about Neil for now, but Barrett, what would you like to talk about?
Sure. Well, actually, in a way, both of your guys' books sort of lead in nicely to the book I'm going to talk about, which is called The Demon-Haunted World. It's a work of nonfiction, though. It's by Carl Sagan, who I'm sure we all at least know the name, at least from the Cosmos, the original Cosmos television series, which I think he did in the, around the early 80s, and which has since been updated by Neil deGrasse Tyson. But Carl Sagan also was a professor of astrophysics at Cornell, and he wrote a lot of books. The reason I say this book kind of ties in with, well, at least with yours, Jenny, we were just kind of talking about, in a larger sense, there's too many books to read. And at some point in this book, he kind of makes the point that it was sort of a depressing thought that, the average person reads X number of books a year, 20 books a year, and you're going to have X number of years. So really, you're only going to read in your lifetime probably less than 1,000 books out of the millions and millions that are out there. And I never really thought about it in those terms before. It's kind of interesting. But anyway, it's sort of the thrust of this book. It's sort of a manual for detecting, as he says, detecting baloney, distinguishing between pseudoscience and actual science. And his another big point of his is, how can we expect to make intelligent decisions in an increasingly technology-driven world when we understand little to nothing about the technology that we're using? And that sort of reminds me a little bit of some of the things that Seth was talking about. So I thought I would actually read just a little bit from this too. He's got, I think, probably one of the better known parts of this book is in a chapter called "The Fine Art of Baloney Detection." And I should mention in this book he talks about everything from UFO sightings to psychics and ESP to media to the government, all kinds of things, and just writes in a really accessible way. He's this brilliant scientist, but he's got a way of writing things. It sort of reminds me of sort of what Leonard Bernstein did for music. I think Carl Sagan is to science in a lot of ways, and making it relatable and understandable to the lay person without a lot of technical knowledge needed. So I'll read you guys a little bit. Let's see. What skeptical thinking boils down to is the means to construct and to understand a reasoned argument, and especially important, to recognize a fallacious or fraudulent argument. The question is not whether we like the conclusion that emerges out of a train of reasoning, but whether the conclusion follows from a premise or starting point and whether that premise is true. Among the tools, whenever possible, there must be independent confirmation of the facts. Encourage substantive debate on the evidence by knowledgeable proponents of all points of view. Arguments from authority carry little weight. Quote, authorities, unquote, have made mistakes in the past. They will do so again in the future. Perhaps a better way to say it is that in science there are no authorities. At most, there are experts. Spin more than one hypothesis. If there's something to be explained, think of all the different ways in which it could be explained. Then think of tests by which you might systematically disprove each of the alternatives. What survives, the hypothesis that resists disproof in this Darwinian selection among multiple working hypotheses, has a much better chance of being the right answer than if you had simply run with the first idea that caught your fancy. Try not to get overly attached to a hypothesis just because it's yours. And that's kind of one of my favorites. I'll cut it off right there because there's quite a few more. But yeah, just again, the sort of the general idea of this book is you shouldn't just accept what you're told, which reminds me a little bit of, you know, television, talking about television media and 24-hour news networks and just sort of sitting in front of a TV and having news told to you rather than wondering about it for yourself. But he kind of goes on and talks about that at length, and he makes a lot of great arguments. He's got some pretty memorable things in here. He talks about one sort of anecdote. At some point in Australia, there was a big in this book was written, by the way, I think in 1996. I think it was the last book, probably the last book he wrote before he died, which he died.
Oh, wow.
Died in 1996. So yeah, about 20 years ago, there was going to be this psychic coming, this kind of mystical psychic healer guy. And there was a lot of excitement building around this. And the media outlets sort of glommed onto it and were getting really excited. There's this guy, he's going to be making an appearance. Well, turned out that it was a fraud that was put on by the Australian version of 60 Minutes to sort of test how gullible the public and the media were at large. And, you know, the point was, you didn't do your work, you didn't check on this, you just accepted what you were told. And I guess that's really sort of the larger point of the book. So it's a really good read, and it's sort of it's written, the chapters are all pretty short, and they all kind of, like I said, they kind of cover a lot of different subjects. So it's not necessarily a book that you need to sit down and read from cover to cover, which I did do and which I would highly recommend. But, you know, if there are things you're kind of interested in, like, you know, obviously a lot of people are interested in UFOs. He makes a lot of really good cases about why we probably aren't being visited by UFOs. And one of the more interesting things he has to say about that, which I thought was a really good point, was, you know, a lot of times people sort of imagine or describe UFOs that they've been abducted by or visited by or whatever in a very similar manner, right? Little green men, little gray men with, you know, big giant eyes, almost like very human looking. And the point he makes is, you know, there's no reason to believe that life originating elsewhere in the universe would have anything to do, would look anything like life on our planet. And in fact, most other life forms other than humans on the planet are wildly more imaginative than what people report as being, you know, alien life. So I thought that was, he says it a lot better than that, but I thought that was kind of a neat point that, you know, UFOs as described by people who are supposedly abducted are wildly unimaginative, even when compared with other forms of life on Earth. So it's
or really that's cool just book. What yeah. UFOs look like, right?
Yeah, that very well could be. But and he says that he's not, you know, he's not dictatorial about this. But his big point is, you have to look at the evidence, and you know that's physically available to you, and make your best decision based on that. So yeah, the demon haunted world. The
it's
subtitle
a great
is,
title.
Yeah, the subtitle is Science as a Candle in the Dark. So yeah, great book. I really enjoyed it.
It sounds really good.
I think I saw an interview with him and maybe Charlie Rose, one of the last interviews he did, and he was talking about this book, and so I was like, okay, you know, I'll pick up that. And it's funny just how kind of one thing will just sort of lead you into another thing. And yeah, it's a really great book. I really liked it a lot.
Sounds really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've watched some of the old Cosmos, and I've watched some of the new Cosmos. I like Neil deGrasse Tyson a lot, although I'm worried about he's got a new TV. I think it's called Star Talk that he's gotten signed to do his own late night talk show on National Geographic. And
he has a podcast that's got the same title, Star Talk.
Yeah, I think it's been signed. So I don't know. I think a lot of these guys are kind of a victim of their own success in a way, and that they rise up because they are good at promoting science, and that's what I love about him, is that he is maybe the best advocate, along with Bill Nye, the science guy, for best advocates for encouraging young people to pursue a career in the sciences. And because they become so successful, they get asked to do more and more, and it popularizes and dilutes it to the point where they're no longer talking content anymore. They're kind of cheerleaders.
Pretty sure Neil deGrasse actually studied with Carl Sagan, or at least went to Cornell when Carl Sagan was teaching there. And he's sort of very much in that vein. But there's something about sort of Carl Sagan's writing and the way he talks about these things that's, for me at least, more captivating while being more in depth. You know, it's like you said, less. I don't know. It's sort of maybe it's a byproduct of the way our culture is now, that we sort of blow these people up, sort of like we do with news anchors. You know,
I think it's all related. Yeah.
Well, and I think it takes a very special kind of mind to be able to think on such a high level and understand the science, and then be able to come back down and explain it to the rest of us.
Yeah.
Because I think most scientists, they just think so high, they could never communicate it.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate people who can.
And I think Neil deGrasse Tyson is capable of that. I think, if I remember right, he wrote a book called The Pluto Files. And I think he's largely responsible for Pluto's demotion from planet to dwarf planet status. So, you know, he is capable of doing hard science, and there's
for sure he's a brilliant guy. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a great book.
It's great. I recommend it.
So, Seth, what else did you bring?
So next I have a classic science fiction work called Neuromancer by William Gibson. The blurb synopsis reads, "The Matrix," which is not The Matrix, "is a world within the world, a global consensus, hallucination, the representation of every byte of data in cyberspace. Case had been the sharpest data thief in the business, until vengeful former employers crippled his nervous system. But now a new and very mysterious employer recruits him for a last chance run. The target? An unthinkingly powerful artificial intelligence orbiting Earth, in service of the sinister Tessier Ashpool business clan. With a dead man riding shotgun and Molly, mirror-eyed street samurai, to watch his back, Case embarks on an adventure that ups the ante on an entire game of fiction. Hotwired to the leading edges of art and technology, Neuromancer ranks with 1984 and Brave New World as one of the century's most potent visions of the future."
So, I love that book so much.
This book popularized the term cyberspace. He actually coined it in an earlier story called Burning Chrome, which I haven't read. But this book is where it really became popular. It's really foresightful in not just cyberspace and internet technology, but also things like cybernetics and biological modifications. A lot of the characters, for example, Molly, who's mentioned in the synopsis, has actual mirrors grafted into her eye sockets that kind of enhance her vision. Case, the main character, has his pancreas actually replaced so that he can't process drugs, because one of his problems is he's a drug addict. And so this new employer hires him, and he's like, okay, you're done with that. He plugs up his liver and fixes his pancreas so that he doesn't react to cocaine and amphetamines anymore. So I think the book is really prescient about our relationship with technology, and just the prediction of cyberspace and the internet in the 90s.
When was this written?
It was published in 1984.
Okay.
He wrote it a year. In fact, he wrote it kind of in a panic. The Ace Books had commissioned him for a novel, and he had a year to write it. And he wasn't really sure it was going to turn out. So it's a really good book. I don't know that, Jenny, you really like it a lot. I don't know that I like it for the ideas that it has, but I guess one of my litmus tests for a work of fiction is that it has to have at least one character who I'd not necessarily like, but would like to spend time with. And I don't know that I really liked any of the people in this book very
much.
That's
a really interesting rule.
You know, that was exactly, I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly why I didn't really get into Game of Thrones, I think. I hated everybody in that, you know?
Hmm.
Yeah, and it's not a hard and fast rule. I mean, they're like the first Game of Thrones. I did enjoy that book, in spite of the fact that it failed the test. Pulp Fiction is another example where I really wouldn't want to spend any time with those characters, but really appreciated the movie. So, like I said, but it's kind of a rule of thumb for me. Like an example is the Great counterexample is the Great Gatsby, which is, you know, filled with kind of sleazy, despicable, yucky characters, but you have this kind of unassuming guy telling the story who may not be perfect, but he's more or less likable, and you're like, yeah, I could hang out with you and listen to you talk about this Gatsby guy and Daisy and all of that. So anyway, Neuromancer, I mean, Case is a drug addict, and most of the other characters aren't a whole lot better, although there are one or two. He has a girlfriend early on who features again later in the book, who is pretty neat. But yeah, if nothing else, for the ideas that this book presents, it basically started this genre called cyberpunk, which kind of mixes the aesthetic of the punk marginalized society, crime, drug dealer, drug culture with technology. Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, which came out about 5 or 10 years later, is another. I actually really like that book. I like it better, but I think one advantage Stevenson had is he wrote it a little later when technology was a little more developed. So,
yeah, I mean, the thing about William Gibson is he anticipated a lot of it.
Yeah.
And you just, when you read it now, it doesn't feel as new as it must have felt back then. I mean, it was such a new way of writing. And
that's what I was going to ask is, like, you know, the ideas, I think, sound really interesting. Does it feel dated going back to read it now? You know what I mean? Like, when I see a movie like Blade Runner now, and the movie starts with, you know, in the year 2015 or something, you know what I mean? Does it have that, any of that going on? Or?
It doesn't feel that bad. Like, yeah, it's always interesting reading old, especially, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah.
I mean, well, 1984, for example.
Like, I really like that. You know, not a negative thing. Like, I that's fascinating to me how what people sort of imagine and sort of how, you know, what they get right and what they're way off on. It's always really interesting.
But yeah, I think Jenny's right that if I had read this 30 years ago, I think I would have been more blown away. Well, I'd have been 4 years old, but you know what I mean.
I think it would have just really captured your imagination in a different way.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to be like, no, this book is the greatest book. But, you know, no, I do think it, in the time period that it was written, it was really something.
I was wondering if you had read the other two in the trilogy? Not yet.
Okay. My favorite one of the three is the second one, which no one ever talks about. It's called Count Zero. So much of it is kind of in this... Well, it's kind of in cyberspace in a mystical way. I don't know. I mean, there are things happening, and when you read the description, it's like a corporate mercenary wakes in a reconstructed body, a beautiful woman by his side. It sounds like this like crime novel, but most of it's very kind of nebulous, and I really liked it. But I don't think it's anyone else's favorite.
I think I'm unique. I enjoyed the parts of this book that took place in cyberspace. I enjoyed his idea of the Matrix as, you know, it's data visualization, essentially, where points of data are actually physically represented on this grid, kind of the way he describes it kind of sounds like Tron in a way.
That's exactly what I was just saying. Yeah.
It's kind of Tron-like. So I wish the parts of the novel I enjoyed most took place in that world. And I think the reason that works for me so well is it lends itself very well to metaphorical thinking and symbolism. That's why The Matrix worked so well for me, the movie. And why the subsequent Matrix movies didn't work for me, especially the last one is just kind of straight up science fiction action where they're shooting these machines and it's great eye candy, but there's no metaphor there. There's no depth. So actually, yeah, I'll definitely check out Count Zero.
And what's the third book called?
Mona Lisa Overdrive.
Oh, the titles are great.
That's a great title. Yeah.
Worth it for the titles alone.
Absolutely.
It's funny because I've read a lot of the author's books since, and these are still my favorite of everything he's written.
Yeah, because he's still around. He wrote a book called Spook Country a while back, which I have not read, and I don't even really know what it's about.
It's about a woman who is really good at advertising and wears jeans a lot. That's all I remember. I remember being in Japan. He likes to write about Japan these days.
Yeah, Neuromancer actually starts in Japan. Which I wish I had the first line, because the first line is very cool. It's sort of set in, to go back to what you were asking about, Barrett, of whether it feels relevant, it's sort of set in a world where the United States has been kind of destroyed. It's now called the Sprawl. And so it's a late Cold War era, I think a lot of those fears about Cold War and national destruction are still pretty prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, but especially in the '80s when you wrote it.
Yeah.
And there's this line in the second book that I'll never forget: "Sprawl Town's a twisty place, my friend. Things are rarely what they seem."
Okay, here's the first line of Neuromancer: "The sky above the port was the color of television tuned to a dead channel."
It's one of the best first lines ever.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So it really, I don't think he comes out and says it, but I think some sort of nuclear action has happened at some point that has kind of poisoned the sky or made the atmosphere more noxious than it is now.
Yeah. Which I think, wasn't that also the case in the Matrix movie?
Yeah. I was thinking about that. Yeah. I remember in the Matrix, the humans had actually torched the sky because they thought it would, because the sun at that point was the major power
source of
machines, and so that's why the machines ended up kind of harvesting humans.
That's right. Yeah.
So yeah, Neuromancer, like I said, I like the writing I like of Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash a little better. And that one is pretty heavy on virtual reality. There's a construct called the metaverse, which is, if you've ever heard of or gone into that program or game called Second Life, Second Life is based off of Neal Stephenson's metaverse. So very similar aesthetic and all of that. So I'd like to read more cyberpunk, although I think the genre is kind of dead now that these books were written when technology was growing up, but it was still marginalized, and so I think it kind of plays off of the marginalization of technology. And now that everyone has smartphones and the internet, it's lost a lot of its mystique.
We are cyberpunk now, basically.
Yeah. Right.
Only it can't be punk if everyone's doing it, so...
That's true.
Yeah.
Cyber pop, I guess.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like cyberpunk's been supplanted with... I call it post-human lit, where, people have evolved in some way to the next phase. There's a lot of books that are set in a kind of quantum reality with... super evolved humans.
Yeah.
I've read a few of those and I really like them.
Yeah.
What you got, Jenny?
Oh, well, this is a little different of a direction. It's called, it's translated from Italian, and it's in the literary world. So yeah, very big change. This book is My Brilliant Friend, L'Amica Geniale, however you say that in Italian, by Elena Ferrante. And it's the first book in a series of three books, and it's kind of one of these kind of biography-based novels. So it feels like it's a memoir, but it's not a memoir. And so this book, it has two sections, childhood and adolescence. And it's basically, it's right after World War II. It's in Tuscany, in a very poor town, a very violent town. There's a lot of fighting between the families and fighting between the children and poverty. And there's some, like, the only way out is if you can get educated, and only a few people get to go that far because no one can afford to pay for it, that kind of thing. I think I'll read just a little bit because it's hard to really get the tone of it across otherwise. This is from the childhood section, which is actually a pretty small part of the book. I feel no nostalgia for our childhood. It was full of violence. Every sort of thing happened at home and outside every day, but I don't recall ever having ever thought that the life we had there was particularly bad. Life was like that. We grew up with the duty to make it difficult for others before they made it difficult for us. Of course, I would have liked the nice manners that the teacher and the priest preached, but I felt that those ways were not suited to our neighborhood, even if you were a girl. The women fought among themselves more than the men. They pulled each other's hair. They hurt each other. To cause pain was a disease. As a child, I imagined tiny, almost invisible animals that arrived in the neighborhood at night. They came from the ponds, from the abandoned train cars beyond the embankment, from the stinking grasses called fetienti, from the frogs, the salamanders, the flies, the rocks, the dust, and entered the water and the food in the air, making our mothers, our grandmothers, as angry as starving dogs. They were more severely infected than the men, because while men were always getting furious, they calmed down in the end. Women, who appeared to be silent, acquiescent, when they were angry, flew into a rage that had no end.
Wow.
So that kind of sets the stage for the town.
Yeah.
Happy little book.
Yeah. I think that was what was most surprising to me, because I kept hearing that these were like the Italian Jane Austen. And I didn't see anything like Jane Austen anywhere in these books. So I've only read the first one of the three. I'm planning on reading the rest of them. But the majority of this book is about Elena. She's the main character and her best friend. But they kind of start out as frenemies when the little girl shoves her doll down the grate, to the sewer, and makes her go knock on the door of the person that is like the villain in the town. So that's how it starts.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds very well realized and imaginative. I mean, the little bit about the animals is really neat.
Yeah, you really feel like you're there. And there's just so much, the violence was the most shocking part, I think, just between everyone. And there's also kind of this underlying theme of all these bad things happen in the war, which we will never talk about.
Yeah.
There's like the before and the after, and this is the after.
It's a translation, right? You mentioned it was Italian. Yeah. How did it read? Was it pretty smooth, or you felt like...
Yeah, I felt like it was
pretty
well done. I mean, that's a hard one, right? You can always feel when it's badly done, but it's hard to articulate when it's well done, you know?
Yeah,
that's good. I mean, just forget that you're reading a translation.
And they do keep a few Italian words in there when it makes more sense, and all the names are still the same.
Yeah.
To the extent that they give you, like, a list of characters at the beginning, because so many Italian names are so similar to one another if you're not Italian.
Yeah.
And it really is important, like, which family people belong to. So that does help.
Almost like a Shakespearean drama, in that way you have a dramatis personae at the beginning.
Yeah.
So you said it's been called Italian Jane Austen. Does the adolescence portion have any hints of a budding romance starting up, or?
Well, it does. And I mean, I think they're talking about Jane Austen in the sense of the characters maybe being representative of parts of society.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I can give them that. But when they said Jane Austen, I was expecting maybe a certain class level.
It's not a novel of manners, or you know,
it is like not that. A novel of manners. These people are poorer than manners. So I was just surprised by that. But yeah, I mean, it really very much is about society and moving between groups. And her friend has a very different future than Elena does. Because her friend is the child of a shoemaker, and obviously they're not going to have any money. And I can't remember if she'd gotten married by the end. There's definitely marriage in the air, and I'm pretty sure that that's probably how the second book starts, is with weddings and children. And I'm not sure where it goes after that.
It sounds like I like the idea of doing a memoir. I've never really been a fan of real memoirs written by people. There's just something kind of implicitly egocentric. Yeah, yeah. Pretentious or egocentric about doing a memoir. I don't know. I would have to do some pretty great things in life, like go to Mars or something. Like,
yeah.
I read Chris Hadfield's memoir. He's the astronaut who did Space Oddity on the International Space Station. And that, I'm like, okay, you've earned the right to do a memoir. You've like done several space missions, and I don't know. And I feel like a jerk for feeling this way, but it's how I feel. And so, like, I would never discourage someone if they said I'm writing a memoir. I'd be like, yeah, you shouldn't do that. But
right,
for my own reading preferences, I generally. But the idea of a memoir that's fiction, I kind of like, because you know it. I mean, I guess it's more honest in a way, because ultimately a memoir is fiction. I mean, it's in the sense that it's selective, in the sense that you're sort of
editing your life.
Yeah exactly. So at least, you know, if it's a fictional memoir, it's being a little more honest about, okay, this is fiction. This is a story the way that I would want to tell it. So I don't know. It sounds neat.
I like that it probably has like a really strong sort of, you said it's set in Tuscany right after World War II, and I remember, I can't remember what author it was. I was listening to an interview with an Israeli author, and he sort of made the point that, you know, a lot of the time it's the provincial novel, or the novel that's set in a small, you know, region specific location. And I thought that was a really good point, because I think I sort of agree with that. He said sort of the provincial novel versus the airport novel, you know, that you just pick up at the news kiosk or whatever. So it sounds like it's a really neat book.
Yeah, and I should clarify, because when you said Tuscany back to me, I'm like, oh, that's not right. It's Naples. Oh, I mean, well. You repeated what I had said, but sure. It's Naples, not Tuscany.
Well, you know, okay.
Yeah, still.
There's a strong accent to it, you know. Mm-hmm. Either whatever region you're in.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
it was interesting you pointing out the denial of the atrocities that happened in the war, because I think that's a powerful thing on both sides, both, you know, in the Italian and German communities, and also, you know, in Jewish kind of Holocaust surviving community that I've grown up in a little bit, because I was raised Jewish. That powerful tendency to kind of deny what happened, or suppress the awful things that happened during the war.
Yeah. The time it's set too, you have to imagine in these villages, there are probably still bombed out buildings too. So this is being, you know, this is being ignored and denied while the physical scars are still, you know, are still there, which is not, you know, that's like you said, it kind of every culture sort of has its things they do that with.
Right, and I think it was even more intricate than that, because it was definitely not acceptable to talk about, but at the same time, a lot of the conflicts between families originated from things that happened during the war, especially when people's sons went off to fight, and maybe one made it back and one didn't, or one didn't have to fight, and that's clearly the core of some of the conflict, but we don't talk about it. So they can't ever move past it, and that affects everything that goes on.
Huh.
So it's fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll have to read the rest and maybe talk about those later on in the year.
Yeah. To be continued.
Yeah. So how about you, Barrett? What's your other book?
All right. Well, I stuck with the same author, but this is a work of fiction. So this is another Carl Sagan book, and it's continuing our science fiction theme. This book is called Contact, and you may have heard of it because it was made into a movie.
Jodie Foster.
Yeah, I never saw it, but late 90s, Jodie Foster and a young Matthew McConaughey, too, actually. All right. So let's see. I think it was published around 1984, 1985. But what's really cool about this book, what I really liked about it, you know, sort of in the vein of maybe Arthur Clarke or Isaac Asimov, where you have a scientist, someone who has a lot of technical know-how, writing a work of fiction. So this sort of, to him, was a likely scenario for making contact with extraterrestrial life. And sort of the way he imagines this will happen is through radio astronomy. And this is, you know, it is the case in the United States and around the world that there are sort of radio astronomy telescopes and arrays set up that are actively searching for signals, not just from extraterrestrial life, just sort of searching for, you know, other things in the universe through other galaxies and stars and things like that. What he imagines will happen is in the book, the protagonist, her name is Ellie, who's played by Jodie Foster, I think, in the movie. She's at the Very Large Array, the VLA, which is in New Mexico, I think, and they see this signal that they distinguish from being just normal part of the what you call the cosmic background radiation. They receive this signal that's plainly intentional, because what the signal is in binary code is a repeating series of prime numbers. So it's obviously geared to sort of get the attention of humanity. And they receive the single signal, and it sets off a lot of excitement. And they determine that it's coming from a star that's actually not that far away in our galaxy, the star Vega, which I think in the book they say is like 25 light years away, something like that. So relatively close.
Yeah.
So they discover this, and they sort of gather all the scientists together, and the book is sort of laid out in three parts. The first part is called The Message. So this is the message they're receiving, and they figure out that this message is sort of in it's sort of a threefold message. The first part of it is this repeating series of prime numbers, and the second part is they're gathering around, sort of putting it together and looking at it from different ways, these radio waves they're receiving. And what's the second thing that's being sent back to them is the broadcast from the 1936 Berlin Olympics. So, and as it turns out, this is one of the first, he says in the book, this is one of the first signals from Earth strong enough to make it through the atmosphere and out into space. So if someone does, if some other civilization does pick up something, it's likely that something like that would be the first thing. It's Hitler welcoming the world,
yeah,
to the 1936 Berlin Olympics. So that is sent back to them on Earth. And then what they get after that, it's sort of deeper in this signal they're getting, are this thousands and thousands of pages, like tens of thousands of pages of code, of binary code. So they have to kind of, that's the first part of the book, just have to sort of figure out what this is. And what they determine is what they're being sent are very elaborate and specific plans for the construction of a machine. And that takes you into the second part of the book, which is called The Machine. And it's not really clear, you know, how to do it or whatever, because they have all this code and this language, but they don't have any way of sort of interpreting it. So the sort of the last piece of the puzzle they find is that this sort of a primer that's included for reading this message they're being sent. And the way it sort of works, it's kind of cool. They're sent simple mathematical problems in this coded language, so simple that it's like 1 + 1 = 2, that's, you know, and then true after that in whatever language. And through looking at this sort of series of mathematical problems, you're able to determine what are the symbols for elementary words like plus or minus or equals and numbers. And then going from there, the primer they receive sort of builds on that. So they're able to eventually read this message completely, and they construct this machine, which they're not really sure what's going to do. But it's really interesting what happens, because, you know, this signal is not sent to any one specific nation. you know, it's sent to the world. And this, again, this is another Cold War era book where these tensions are very high. There's a lot of competition, but the signal is sent, you know, to the whole Earth. So the nation, you know, the world kind of has to pull together to cooperate on this thing. And there's a lot, you know, there's sort of a lot of subplots too, like the military, the United States military is very concerned with what this might be. Can it be exploited militarily? What, you know, what's the species going to be? And blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like close to 400 pages, but I think I finished it in like a week or less. Cause it's just, it's really interesting. It just, it feels plausible. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. There's no little green men coming to visit. They do eventually build this machine, and it does take them through the galaxy, through like a series of sort of what are described as, you know, wormholes, which is sort of been hypothesized by physicists. And I guess the most interesting subplot of it is when this message is initially received, there are a lot of sort of evangelical, not just Christians, but a lot of sort of fundamentalist religious leaders who are sort of decrying it and very opposed to it. And there's this character, his name is Palmer Joss, which is quite a name. I think that's the Matthew McConaughey character from the movie, who eventually sort of has a series of meetings with the protagonist Ellie, and they sort of find a common ground. So it's sort of an interesting little part of the book, is that this sort of fanatical religious leader and this other person who you might describe as sort of a fanatical rationalist or fanatical scientist do sort of find a way to meet in the middle, and what ends up happening is, you know, she along with four other scientists go on this sort of this journey throughout the galaxy and eventually do come in contact with this superior intelligence, but when they return to Earth they're left with no proof of this. So essentially what she has to do is ask people to accept her account on faith. You know, which is exactly what these religious people, you know, have been asking, you know, ask her to do and that kind of thing. So it's really fun. They do figure out, you know, she does have some sort of proof in that in her contact with the higher intelligence, they sort of demonstrate to her that there are certain mathematical, you know, ratios or transcendental numbers that are sort of built into the universe that do imply. You can figure out the message coded into the fabric of the universe that comes through at the end. It's a really cool book. If you like science fiction at all, I think it's definitely worth a read, and it reads pretty quickly too, without getting
I don't remember most of the movie, but I do remember how the movie ended, and it was similar to what you're describing, although it plays out a little differently. In the movie, she goes off in the machine alone. Has this sort of spiritual kind of what you're describing, a little bit of a spiritual experience with it, and has contact and comes back, and in Earth time it looks like the machine just kind of launched and came back.
Yeah, it's like and a couple minutes or something.
And
yeah.
So everyone thinks it failed, and like you said, there's no proof, all there is static, but they gets looking at it and there's like 26 hours of static or something that kind of shows how long she's actually been gone.
Yeah. There's nothing like that in the book, but I mean, it's kind of frustrating that there's not, because the sort of the account of their journey is really cool and really tantalizing. It's really neat. What happens is they end up at this sort of place near the center of the galaxy where their ship, there's sort of a dock, I guess, that's been, and sort of anticipating their arrival, and they arrive in this sort of habitat that's constructed to look exactly like Earth, to have the right atmospheric conditions. And what happens is they're there for a little while, and while they're sleeping, their dreams, their minds are read by this higher intelligence. And based on that, they're able to, for each of the members who are on the mission, they're able to sort of generate a likeness of someone who is very important to them on Earth to talk to them in their own language about what they're experiencing and what, you know, what it all means and that kind of thing.
She talks to her dad in the movie.
That happens in the book too. She wakes up and she's, you know, who knows where in the galaxy, and her dad comes walking up, and sort of the rational part of her brain knows that there's no way it's him, but she can't help but just being completely torn apart by it. You know, like, I think her dad passes away. She's maybe 10 or 15 or something like that.
Yeah, so, he dies when she's young. So I guess the unifying theme of this podcast is that, you know, science can do a lot for us and explain a lot for us, but they're are certain limitations and things that it can't explain and can't do.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. It's, yeah, I mean, Sagan, and this is true of the book I mentioned earlier, the Demon Haunted World, he does have a lot of criticism for certain aspects of religion, but these aspects are generally the fundamentalist aspect, and on the whole, I would say he's actually very respectful of religious traditions. I think a lot of times people sort of make the mistake of thinking that science has to negate religion or scientists are anti-religion, and it's definitely not the case. There's a lot of respect for it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an oversimplification for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So did Carl Sagan write any other science fiction that you know of? Or was this his one foray?
So I think this is it. And I was surprised at how good it's not beautiful prose or anything, but it's definitely very good and very imaginative. And I don't think there's anything else. And I think this book actually it started as a screenplay, and then he abandoned it and then turned it into a novel, and then it eventually was made into a movie. So,
well, I think that's how 2001, wasn't it? Arthur C. Clarke had the idea, and he was sort of writing the novel
simultaneously.
Something like that.
It's a cool book. It's a good book.
Sounds really good.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's not a lot I can say about it. It reads, I got through it really quickly, and it's definitely something you could read on a trip and get through, but a really enjoyable, I'd recommend it.
Well, it must have been interesting to read how he thinks people should be addressing these kinds of things, like aliens, and then to have him apply that, I don't know which order he wrote the books, but to see it in fiction form.
Yeah,
did you see any of that in there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are sort of motifs that sort of recur throughout the books that I've read. And this is the most recent book of his that I read. So I'd read all these other things he'd written first. And I sort of would recognize things in this book. Like he comes back to things like, especially during the Cold War, the propensity of nuclear weapons and how ridiculous that is. The need for better education, and all these things are in both Contact and his other books too. So there's definitely a lot of parallels.
Which way do you think it's easier to take? in fiction form, or
I don't know. That's a good question. Oh, that's really interesting. I think for me, if I had to choose one of these two to read, I would choose The Demon Haunted World, just because I feel like it kind of covers more, and it's, while being, I think, a shorter book, actually, it sort of covers more ground. But I feel like probably a lot of people would say Contact.
I wonder if that's why he wrote it, to try to get to a different audience or something.
Yeah, I think that's the point.
It's something that I'm already kind of, I'm early in my academic career, but I'm already struggling with, I'm coming up with ideas about literature and creativity and all that stuff. And like, okay, I can write a doctoral thesis on this stuff. Maybe a dozen people read it. If I'm lucky, it'll get published as an academic book, and maybe, a couple hundred people will read it. Or I can try to, do it in fiction form. And if I get really lucky, that, it could end up getting, widely published and read. So, The good thing is those things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, as Carl Sagan shows. You can do both, but I'm definitely, there are different ways of communicating ideas like this, and I think one isn't more valid than the other.
Yeah,
no, I love how it's in both of them. I really like that a lot, actually.
Yeah. So yeah, it doesn't feel in any way sort of the concepts discussed aren't really dumbed down. I mean, in fact, there was even, I think, a couple things, times in Contact, I had to kind of go back and, wait, what was that? So my science and math background is so limited sometimes. I did have to kind of go reread some things.
I conflate Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov in my mind a lot.
Oh, sure.
Because they seem to similarly span both fiction and nonfiction, and both had careers outside of science fiction writing. It seems like most science fiction writers now, that's what they do. They write science fiction. I don't know. Jenny, do you remember Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian? He's a physicist, right?
I can't remember exactly.
But I think
Ted Chiang is an engineer, I think, and Hani Rajaniemi is a mathematician.
I've never read Hani Rajaniemi, but I've heard good things about his.
Yeah, he's one of those quantum post-human writers. He's from Finland, and he works for some kind of think tank.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of a little different perspective.
Yeah.
But I think that when science fiction writers come from those kinds of backgrounds, it really shows in their writing in a really rich way. So,
yeah, it feels more authentic or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
It's been great.
Thank you. It's fun.
Yeah, it was fun. A lot of fun.
Last call for drinks at the pub and on home.
Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.
Wasn't, you know, kind of bought out by something.
There's a Wikipedia article about history.
Hang on. Would you like me to read to you? Siri, help it out again. I forgot to.
Sorry,
hang on.
Buddy. I'm not sure what you said.
Thanks a lot, Siri.
Get out of here.
I will have some editing to do today. Did you hear?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.